Well, welcome. This is Conservative Messaging 101. This is the first part of a two-part series. Tonight, we're going to talk about some of the theory behind messaging with conservative audiences. And next week, we're going to do sort of a practice workshop, taking what we cover today and putting it to practice. So this is sort of a two-week series, the 101 and 201. We're also going to repeat this two-part series. The intention is to repeat it about three times a year, summer, winter, and fall, and to make sure that the content stays fresh and make sure that it's getting out there on a regular basis. So why a conservative outreach series in the first place? Well, of course, CCL is nonpartisan. However, if we've polled our volunteers, and what we found is that about 80% self-identify as left-leaning, whereas about 10% self-identify as right-leaning, the other 10% being other. And as our conservative caucus co-founder, Grant Couch, likes to say, if we only grow our left wing, we're going to fly around in circles. So we really need to balance this out within our membership. Quickly about me, my name is Peter Brin. I was formerly an engineer with ExxonMobil. I was there for about 8 years. I have been involved with CCL for about 4 years. First three or so, I was, three and a half, I was purely as a volunteer. And in the last year, I've been in a staff role, a conservative director. And my main goal is really to fix those numbers that we saw before, to make sure that our membership is a bit more balanced. One other thing I would point out, there is a preceding CCU lesson called Messaging and Effective Communications. I'd recommend taking a look at it before this one, in fact. You'll notice some of the same themes. Tonight's is going to be focused specifically on conservative audiences, but messaging and effective communications will be helpful as well. Set some of that baseline down so you can take a look at that. Okay, so goals and agenda. So this is what the shared goals for both 101 and 201. First is to improve your skills at engaging conservatives, whether it's going to a presentation or just talking to folks one-on-one. Ultimately, we hope to recruit more conservative volunteers into CCL, and even more so, retain them once they get there. So, once volunteers come in, and if they happen to be conservative, we want to make sure CCL is a welcome place for them, where they feel comfortable, and where they feel like they're not out of place. One thing I would point out, if you are progressive, if you consider yourself, pretty left of center, or whomever you are, I'm not asking anybody to pretend to be something that they're not. Would never do that, don't want you to do that. But this is really just intended to help folks understand better where conservative audiences may be coming from, and to make sure that we're careful with our language. All right, so the agenda for tonight, which is, again, 101, is first covering what I'll say moral theory, sort of understanding the conservative mind. And then the second part is understanding the tribe, conservatism and skepticism. So let's get into the first part, moral theory. Now, we're going to use the work of Jonathan Haidt to work on this, his book called The Righteous Mind. Now, if you've been around CCL for very long, you've probably heard of Jonathan Haidt's work. It's referenced often, and there's a good reason for that, because it's quite helpful, and it sets a really good framework for the rest of this conversation. So he, in his work, he lays out three principles of moral psychology. The first is that intuition comes first, reasoning comes second. The second is that morality, quote, binds and blinds. And the third is that there's more to morality than harm and fairness. Now, we're going to jump in each one of these and figure out what each means. So again, intuition comes first, reasoning comes second. This is probably obvious, but basically he says that we immediately evaluate by intuition. Now, by the way, I'm not a moral psychologist. I'm trying to do my best to channel my inner Jonathan Haidt in this work. So, if I get something a little bit wrong, but basically I'm trying to present what he's presented here. So, we immediately evaluate by intuition, and reason often is not used to see the ultimate truth, but instead to justify the intuition, right? To justify whatever conclusion we've already come to. And so throughout this presentation, we're going to see these red bullet points. These are takeaways. Basically, I want to take all of these different references that we're looking at and turn them into real useful takeaways that we're going to then put into practice next week in our practice session. So the first takeaway is be a trusted messenger. Messenger is often more important than message. So if people's intuition is going to base on who they think you are, who they think you as a person are, whether they trust your message or not, whether they think that they share a world view with you or not. And so it's most important to become a trusted messenger before you try to start selling anybody on a message. Second, first impressions matter, right? Since intuition kicks in immediately, we want to make sure that we're making a good first impression. We're going to spend some time on that next week. Okay, the second principle is morality, quote, binds and blinds. So what does that mean? So morality can bind us together into groups, right? We know that we're very tribal, right? People for since the beginning of time, we've organized ourselves in groups where we find it useful and where we find, you know, people with similar social values. And so we need to understand the tribe because, you know, we bind ourselves together into these groups. People are very tribal. So we need to understand the tribe, and we also need to find validators within that tribe. Who are the trusted voices within that tribe who can bring folks, you know, bring folks along to where we'd like them to be, as opposed to offering voices that you may trust, but they probably are not going to trust very much. And the second piece is that, you know, and this kind of gets to the point of what I just said, is that being in a tribe can blind us to new information. So if you hear information and it challenges the orthodoxy of the tribe, you're probably going to be very skeptical and you may even double down and push back, right? So that is to say, don't lead with science or data. Data are unlikely to convince until you've become a trusted source. As one of our advisory board members, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, likes to say, the last thing the world needs is another report on climate change. That is not going to move people. This has become a social issue where we need to engage folks, not a science issue where we need to teach folks. And that is precisely why I'm, you know, with CCL, because that's exactly what we're trying to do. So don't lead with science or data. And the third principle that he talks about is that there is more to morality than harm and fairness. Now, again, I'm not a moral psychologist, but according to Dr. Haidt, he says that moral study traditionally has focused on harm and fairness. Basically, these being the two ideas that are, you know, foundations to the way that people see the world. However, in his work, he has identified a much richer mix of about six moral foundations that exist in cultures all around the world. And these foundations appear to be instinctive, though prioritizing them can be learned. And what I mean by that is the way that liberals would prioritize these six is a bit different than the way that conservatives would prioritize these six. But everybody has some element of all six of these. And so we're going to walk through them in the next slide one by one and look at also some messaging do's and don'ts that we could learn from this. Now, I know that there's a lot on this slide. So if you follow the big red arrow on the left side, that should keep you in line. So, and keep us all on the same page here. So we're going to start right at the top. The first foundation is the idea of authority and respect. And the description is obey tradition and legitimate authority, law and order. Remember, Donald Trump, President Trump is a law and order candidate. So some messaging do's and don'ts that we can pull from this that might resonate with conservative audience. So we do want to, as I mentioned before, refer to trusted validators. For example, in the corporate world, Department of Defense, these are validators that are authority figures that are trusted by conservatives. By and large, that's certainly not universal, but by and large. We don't want to demonize industry, right? We don't want to demonize the authoritative figures in the business world. We also don't want to talk about radical change being needed quickly, right? There's the idea of obeying tradition, and a radical change represents a departure from tradition. So we want to talk about, you know, gradual planned change, risk management, doing things in a sensible, measured way, right? Radical change is alarmism, and that tends to shut people down. Okay, sanctity, purity. The idea here, or the description, is abhorrence for disgusting things or actions. I would recommend, with conservative audience, talking about reduced emissions and particularly clean air and clean water. That is something that everybody agrees that we could all agree on. We all like. We want to see, you know, a clean planet, and you know, most people oppose litter and trash being around. So, you know, you can resonate on things like reduced emissions because most people are going to want that. The next one is I haven't tried too much, but you know, there's also the idea of nostalgia for an earlier time when nature was undisturbed. Now you risk a little bit sounding like too much of a tree hugger if you go too far with that, but you know, but the nostalgia argument of an earlier time may work. I've heard that made a few times, that argument. So anyway, that's one in the toolbox. Loyalty in group. This gets a little bit back to the tribal idea, right? Standing with your group, your family, or your nation. Now, you know, many conservatives will look at we will look at the world and have trust when it comes to government, much greater trust in local government, of course, than national. So the farther you get away from national, the less trusted it tends to be. So local government tends to be very trusted. State government, pretty well trusted, a little bit less so, but pretty well trusted. National, not very well trusted, and the UN, forget about it. So don't mention the UN or the COP process. That's likely just to invite in, you know, friction. But at the same time, while there's distrust in the federal government, there's, of course, we all share patriotism. And so we should talk about things like American greatness, opportunity, and competitiveness. How do we make America competitive for the 21st century? How do we make America great again, right? How do we become the leaders in the energy, the energy transformation that's likely to happen? How do we become leaders in this new technology and really lead the rest of the world? So those would be things you want to key in on. Liberty, loathing of tyranny. This is where we really want to talk about being market-based. So we do want to talk about letting the market find solutions, not the government, not a bureaucrat. We want to talk about energy freedom, not picking winners and losers. And talk about an all-of-the-above low-carbon energy future, right? All-of-the-above is sort of the energy policy for a lot of Republicans. And, you know, frankly, at CCL, we don't oppose that. We just want to have low-carbon, be a priority and put a price on carbon is the way to do that. So we can have an all-of-the-above energy policy. We agree it should be all-of-the-above. We just want to put a price signal out there to make sure that it's all-of-the-above and low-carbon. We don't want to talk again about regulatory bureaucracy or the EPA as being solutions that we would seek because you're just going to lose your audience. All right, fairness and proportion. It's interesting. The description says rendering justice according to the law. It's interesting. This one always makes me think about how interesting wording is. You know what? Now this is a slightly different idea, but the idea of environmental justice being a big issue to the political left. The idea of justice anyway, on the political left, is in many ways similar to the idea of accountability on the right, right? One person's justice is another person's accountability. It's really just being careful with your language. So what you'll find is a lot of times you'll probably share a lot of these same moral foundations, regardless of where you are in the political spectrum. You might just have different language for it. So we do want to talk in this fairness proportion one about all fuels being fully accountable for their costs, right? We don't want any free riders, whether it's a free riding fuel source or a free riding country, right? China and India, those questions are often brought up. I mean, you hear it all the time. Well, what if we act and they don't? And that's where we talk about the border adjustment in our policy, you know, that would make sure that those countries are held accountable for if they don't act. And then there's also the hypocrisy argument, and I hear this one a lot, right? What about Al Gore's big mansion in Tennessee? Well, I often say to that, I would say, you know, I don't think anybody should tell Al Gore how to live his life. If Al wants to have a big mansion and heat his pool, that's fine. Let him do that. I have no problem with that, right? We don't want it, the government or anybody telling Al how to live his life. But we do want him to be held accountable for his decisions. So if he wants to keep his pool heated to 85 degrees all year round, well, that's fine, but he's going to pay for it, right? And he's going to pay, he's going to pay whatever that cost to society is in the fuel now. And I've made that argument a few times, and it's usually received pretty well. So you want to be careful about that. So, and then finally, care, cherishing and protecting others. We do want to talk about care for future generations, our grandchildren. I think that's one way to really bring this in. I would stick to caring for people, caring for the planet. You know, of course, we all do care for the planet, but again, that risks sounding a little a little potentially tree hugger-ish. So again, you just want to be careful about that. Okay, so this slide is basically my attempt to do a takeaway summary. So these are a lot of the takeaways that we've captured in the last couple of minutes here. And most of these we're going to use in the 201 session in practice. That's why it's faded out. But the remainder of tonight's talk, we're going to try to understand the tribe. We're going to spend time looking at understanding the conservative mind and understanding both conservatism and skepticism, because they're related in a lot of ways, but they're two different things. And to make that point, I just showed this Venn diagram, which shows that, and we're actually going to put some numbers to this a little bit later. But, the short answer here is that not all conservatives are climate skeptics, and not all climate skeptics are conservative. So keep that in mind, because we want to really be careful with how we think about people and our preconceived notions about them. Remember, not all conservatives are climate skeptics, and vice versa. So to get through this section, we're going to look at first we're going to talk about the modern Republican Party. This is a source from the New York Times. It's called The Republican Herd. I found it to be a pretty interesting and useful source. And then there's a number of other resources that we're going to go through that talk specifically about Republicans and their views on climate change. So the first thing is this from the New York Times. Now, obviously, the New York Times is not very well respected by many on the right, but I think it's done a nice job with this, and there's a similar diagram for the Democrat Party as well, so it sort of shows both. But this is an attempt to look at the modern Republican Party and really show the diversity within the party. Now, it's broken up in two ways, left and right, so sort of on the x-axis, so to speak. So to the left are those that really are skeptical of President Trump and have not necessarily jumped on with him fully. And then as you move farther to the right, it's moving toward those who really support the president. And as far as coalitions, you see in red at the top, you have this cultural coalition. The blue in the middle is the anti-tax, anti-spend coalition. At the bottom in gray are the national security-focused folks, and then libertarians kind of on the left side in a light green. And we're going to walk through each one of these. So the cultural coalition. Right. This is sort of I find pretty interesting. So they break it into four primary groups. This, generally speaking, I think we would also refer to as social conservatives. You might hear in the group that is a little more skeptical of President Trump. You have, folks who just really have not been able to get on to support him, did not support him in the election, primarily on moral grounds. They just couldn't abide the president's statements. Then you have sort of the biblical bloc. These are sort of the Ted Cruz's and Mike Pence's of the world. These folks vary from being skeptical of Trump to being very supportive. Then you have the cultural protectionist bloc. These, you could say, are sort of the more firebrand kind of folks like Ann Coulter and Rudy Giuliani. And then all the way at the far right, you have a relatively small but group that has garnered a lot of attention. The alt-right, Steve Bannon being one of the key figureheads in that group. Then you have the anti-tax, anti-spend coalition. And so there's two primary blocks here. You have a group shown on the left, sort of the free market block. This would also be known more traditionally as probably Rockefeller Republicans, more recently the establishment or governing conservatives. These are people like Paul Ryan, Mitt Romney, John Boehner. And probably in the in full disclosure, my guess is that probably most of the conservative caucus within CCL would mostly identify with this group. That's definitely true for me, and I think for probably some others as well. Then you have on the other side a larger elephant, and I think I may have mentioned that the size of the each elephant is representative of the size of the group within the party. And so this is actually very different than the free market bloc. This is a very populist sort of pessimist view, a very anti-Washington bloc. And this traditionally has been the Tea Party, and President Trump sort of came up out of this crowd. And then in the military national security bloc, you have, again, two somewhat different views on things. On the left, you have the interventionists. These tend to be more military hawk folks that have supported the world order over the last, you know, well, basically since World War II, where America has pretty much intervened all over the world and sort of set the world order. And then you have what they call the America First crowd, which is, you know, strong on terrorism, but is not really interested in continuing a world order where the United States has people all over the world, or at least not in the form that we've seen it. So again, two very different views within the same party. And finally, the libertarian leaning group, also known as the Liberty Movement. You might hear of Liberty Clubs around the country. And, you know, Koch brothers, Rand Paul are sort of some of the figureheads for this group. Honestly, I would have thought this group is a little bit bigger than it's shown here, but anyway, that's some perspective. So the point of sharing all this is not, so there's no test on this. It's really just to emphasize that the Republican Party, conservative movement in general today, is not monolithic at all in thought, you know, and so different strategies are going to resonate with different audiences, and different groups are going to have potentially very different opinions on climate change. And the need for action, among other things. So now we're going to get into some sources that specifically talk about where conservatives are on climate change specifically. So this first graph, this slide and the next slide are from ClearPath, and they've done a lot of really good work trying to understand where the current party is, and so they've done a lot of polling. They have, on this graph, they have three groups of bars. On the left is all. This is, you know, all across the society. In the middle is polling of GOP members, and on the right are conservative GOP. And the bars represent from the blue, which climate's changing and human activity is contributing a lot to the change, all the way down to the orange, which basically is climate is not even changing. And what's interesting, well, there's two main takeaways to me out of this graph. One is that, as you can see, about 55% of GOP and conservative GOP accept that human activity is contributing at least a little to the change. So there's some acknowledgement there. The other thing is that I find very interesting is how similar the polling is between GOP and conservative GOP. So, you know, who identify as very conservative, they're really pretty close on climate to the rest of the party, which I actually take to be a good sign in terms of where they are. So that was one takeaway I came from this. The other thing that they stated, and this sort of supports our comments before about clean air, clean water, similarly, talking about clean energy, keeping us healthier, safer, and more prosperous, this polls well. Among everybody, but Republicans included. And so, you know, if we can frame our message in terms of, you know, clean energy and some of the side benefits, then I think we'll do well for ourselves. The next study is one that I'm sure many on the line are familiar with. This is the Yale George Mason work, the Center for Climate Communication. And they originally developed this quite a while ago, back in 2009, I believe, and there's been other polling, a lot of other polling done since, but this Six America study has sort of served as a foundation for understanding where the public at large is on climate change, even if the numbers have probably changed over time. And so they bucket people into six categories, which every bar on this graph on the left is in one of those categories. So first, they have the alarmed. These are the folks that probably like us on the phone tonight who are not only concerned about climate change, but are actually trying to do something about it, regularly contacting Congress and that kind of thing. Then you have the concerned category. These are people who are concerned about the issue, but they're not necessarily active on it. They may take an occasional action, but, you know, they're not very active. Then you have people who are cautious. These tend to be folks who could sort of go either way. You know, they're aware of climate change, but they don't know much about it. They don't deny it's happening or, you know, they're not dissenters, but they just don't know a lot about it. Then you have disengaged. These tend to be folks that are really just focused on, you know, a lot of whom are living paycheck to paycheck, just focus on their own lives, just trying to get through the day and really don't focus much on things outside of their own world politically or otherwise. And so they're not really engaged in this at all. Then you have the doubtful. You know, these are folks that are very skeptical of climate change, you know, or probably think some of the hoax theories may have some, some validity to them. They can probably be reached, you know, and maybe moved one or two steps up the scale. They might be open to solutions, but they're pretty skeptical. And then you get the dismissive crowd, and you know, those are the folks who just won't accept it, regardless of what your argument is or what you say. And so I think really what the focus there is to mitigate dissent, right? We just need to mitigate their dissent, acknowledge their views, and sort of move on. So the width of each of these bars represents the percentage of the country or, you know, in terms of polling where people are. So you can see the concerned group is the largest. And the obviously the color bars represent the party that they're in. So if you look at the red ones, what you find, and I've summarized this in the table at the right, basically those in the alarmed, concerned, or cautious category. So these are basically people who are already there or could be convinced, and represent about half of Republicans, a little less than half, 46%. Those that are either disengaged or doubtful or dismissive are about 54%. So, you know, roughly speaking, half and half, obviously in favor of the crowd that is dissents from the climate science. But again, this polling is old, and we have other polling that's newer that shows, you know, that the numbers are probably better than this, but still about 50-50. So I think that's useful to understand. And using those numbers, we're going to revisit this Venn diagram we looked at earlier and note that again, Republicans make up about 32% of the population, which is consistent with what the polling said. And what we find is about half and half, right? 16% are Republicans who accept climate science. 16% are, you know, dissenting. And again, I'm using the doubtful and dismissive categories to define climate skeptic in this case. And then you've got about 10, and these are all these numbers on the screen are of the entire U.S. population. So 16% of the U.S. population are Republicans who accept climate science, 16% are Republicans who don't accept it, and you've got about 10% who don't accept climate science who are not Republican or some other political affiliation. So again, the whole point is just to remember that Republicans are not monolithic in thought, and there's a lot of variety in viewpoints. So, again, to get back to this point, don't say Republicans don't accept climate change science, because, first of all, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you engage a Republican or a conservative who is accepting of climate change science, and you go up to them and say, Republicans don't care about climate change, that's going to serve only to turn that person off, right? They're going to say, well, you know, I was going to give you a shot. I was actually going to tell you that I do care about this, but if you're not going to accept that I care about it anyway and that my peers care about it, then I think that person is more likely to shut down. So I think you need to keep the door very much open and say, yeah, you know, some don't accept it, but a lot do. And you know, be very honest about that. Secondly, don't say it because it's not true, right? As we just saw a minute ago, about a quarter of the population are concerned or alarmed by climate change, a quarter are cautious, a quarter are doubtful, and a quarter are dismissive, which is higher than we'd like to see, but certainly not, you know, if it's far from 100%. Also, Republicans are interested in side benefits like prosperity, health, and safety. So keep that in mind as well. The other thing is, if you look at young Republicans and college Republicans, so this is a really interesting report that you can download. It's public. It's called Growing Up GOP. You can reach it at millennial.gop. And this is a report done by the College Republican National Committee. And they basically, through focus groups and polling, worked with college Republicans for membership to ask them different questions about what they'd like to see in their party. And one of the questions in the focus groups, they said, was, what are the top six desired attributes you'd like to see in the party? And at number six on this list, out of, I don't know how long the list was, but I'm sure it was way more than six, but making the top six was takes action to address climate change, which I thought was very telling. And it sort of went hand in hand with this other polling that we saw from the Young Conservatives for Energy Reform. This is an organization that is, membership-based organization focused on energy reform and basically in favor of, they tend to focus a lot on renewables, but In recent polling, they found that 85% of young Republicans, not necessarily just their membership, but young Republicans broadly, recognize that the climate is changing. About 65% recognize that at least half of that is human caused. So the big takeaway here is that young Republicans are ready to act. And we've taken that lesson now that we have some data to back our suspicions, which, I mean, I suspected that was the case anyway. And we've taken those data and we're now using that in the conservative caucus to really focus outreach to young Republicans. The last resource we're going to look at tonight is Eco America study. And Eco America, they were actually at our conference, I believe, in 2015. And they did this American Climate Values. They have this thing called the Classic Findings Overview. And they've done a lot of, again, focus group work and polling. And they came up with 10 findings. We're going to focus on three of them because I think, A, I think these are some of the most important three, and B, we've covered a number of these other findings that are grayed out. So we're just going to focus on the three that we haven't touched on yet. Not ready to abandon the American dream. This, I think, is a really critical one. And Congressman Bob Inglis on our advisory board is often quoted as saying, solution aversion is at the heart of climate skepticism. So what do we mean by that? Well, if you go to, let's say you go to a dinner at a local Republican club, and you sit next to this guy on the left side of the screen, and he turns to your dinner and gives you this look, right, this scowl on his face, and you say climate change. What does he hear? He doesn't hear climate change. He hears Uncle Sam coming for his wallet. He hears, hey, I want you to give up your car and air conditioning because, you know, the sea level might go up a couple millimeters over the next century, right? That's what's going through his mind. I want you to give more control to the government, right? These are obviously things that are not very popular with this gentleman. And so I think one of the key things we need to do is tackle solution aversion up front. Say, we are not talking about giving up our way of life. We're talking about more mobility. We're talking about having, you know, just doing energy better and smarter, but continuing to improve quality of life for people all across the world, including here in the U.S. And if we can give that message coupled with a low carbon message, we'll be much more successful to try to get over his fears that you're trying to come after his, you know, his way of life. The other thing we have to think about, the next item that they put on here is competing priorities. Recognizing that, you know, people, especially conservatives, that, you know, even those that recognize climate change as an issue, it's probably not at the top of their list, right? There are many other issues they're concerned about. They're concerned about ISIS. They're concerned about rights to life or protecting life. They're concerned about Second Amendment, things like that. So, you know, we need to avoid hyperbole because while climate change may be urgent, it's, again, it's not on everybody's radar, and alarmism just tends to create anxiety, which leads to inaction. So we have to respect that people have competing concerns and say, look, I totally understand your priorities are X, Y, and Z. I think this is another important priority. What do you think? You know, and we don't need people to move it to the top of their list. We just need them to acknowledge, yeah, this is an important thing and we should act on it. Okay, finally, the curse of techno-optimism. What does this mean exactly? So this is the idea that, well, you know, technology is going to save us. It's going to get us out of this, so we don't have to worry about it. And, you know, to that, I would have kind of a two-part answer. I would say, well, yeah, technology is going to have to get us out of this. We need technology to deliver the solutions that are going to get us out of it. That's true. However, technology only exists if there's a price signal to sell that technology. Technology doesn't just come around for the heck of it. It comes around because there's a market for it, right? And so without a price on carbon, there is no incentive. There is no market for clean energy that is going to be substantial enough to solve this problem. Now, we could take a gamble and assume that maybe clean energy will get so cheap so fast that we don't need a carbon price, but I'm personally not willing to take that gamble. So having said that, I think we need to, the takeaway here is to discuss clean energy very carefully. We do want to talk about decarbonizing the economy as a real business case. So for example, nuclear, natural gas sequestration, wind, solar, all these examples where real business case can be made about energy sources. We do want the U.S. to lead, right? We want the U.S. to lead the world in these technologies. We don't want to oversell, however, the natural pace of clean energy as it undercuts the need for a carbon price. If we, and I've I've personally experienced this many times. I've gone to presentations where they say, oh my God, renewables are growing so fast and they're all over the place. And, you know, in 10 years, the whole world's going to be solar, which I don't personally believe is true. But, you know, they'll make claims that sound pretty outrageous. And I hope it's true. I don't think it's going to be true. But I walk away thinking, well, boy, then what the heck, what do we need a carbon tax for? Why do we need a price on carbon? So you're going to be careful not to oversell the natural pace of clean energy, because I don't think, frankly, it aligns with reality. And I think it undercuts our argument. And also, we got to be careful not to present this as anti-fossil fuel. We're not opposed to fossil fuels. We just want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So we got to be very careful, again, about how we discuss clean energy. Finally, the last thing I want to share tonight is I would just suggest do your homework. Study dismissive messengers. I would recommend you get familiar with some of the climate dismissive messaging. You know, these are folks, I have a few examples at the bottom. Dr. Neil Frank, he's here in Houston. His talks, actually, it was amazing. He covered just about every dismissive argument I've ever heard in one 45-minute talk. I mean, he hit on everything. And there's a couple other things you can just search. Fox News Climate Change Denial on YouTube or on Google, and you'll have a bunch of videos come up. And I'm not picking on anybody there. It's just the reality of it. I mean, that's the world we're in. You're going to find a lot of stuff out there. But it's important to watch these things and become familiar with some of the arguments that your audience is hearing for themselves, because you need to understand where they're coming from. And the best way to do that is to listen to the messengers that a lot, that most of them trust. And so, you know, it may be frustrating. It might drive you nuts because you're going to hear things that you know are incorrect, but that's okay. Listen to it, understand it. And most importantly, be respectful of the fact that these are things that people care about. Be respectful of the fact that your audience is going to take a lot of these arguments to heart and really have legitimate concerns about the message we're trying to bring them. So with that, I'm going to just wrap up here, this takeaway summary slide. Again, for 101, which is what we did tonight, the theory, this was understanding the tribe. Republicans are not monolithic in thought. There's a lot of diversity in the party. Republicans are evenly distributed on climate change in terms of their views. Young Republicans are clearly ready to act. Solution aversion is at the heart of skepticism. I can't say that enough. You know, again, get ahead of that solution aversion as quickly as you can. And finally, do your homework. Study dismissive messengers. The rest of the lessons we're going to cover next week in our practice session as we try to craft some of our arguments. And with that, I'm going to close it out and thank everybody for joining. Bye-bye, everybody.